So in this talk, I would like to give you a perspective of my work on topological quantum error correction over more than a decade now. And this sticker that you see here on the lower part of the screen, I will be using it to identify my own work during the talk, which is given the nature of the talk, I think it's useful. So whenever you see the sticker, that's my work. OK, so let's start with some motivation. So in my field, the motivation is pretty clear. We want to build a quantum computer. That's it, very practical. And so what is a quantum computer? So in a quantum computer, you have a collection of physical systems, typically, or subsystems, typically qubits, two-level quantum systems. And you want to, you can control them perfectly. So you can perform some unitary on them, some black box here. And then we are going to measure them in some basis. During this talk, I will be using this circuit notation where qubits, the life of the qubits is denoted by some line, and then we have gates as the one inside this box here where, so these are unitaries acting on a few qubits, say two qubits at a time. And our like big unitary composing the quantum computation will be made up of such a small unitaries acting on a small number of qubits, like one or two. So that's what a quantum computer can do, and why should we want to have such a thing? Well, the original motivation due to Feynman is that if we want to simulate physical systems, then we probably need a quantum computer because classical computers will not be efficient at simulating physical systems that are quantum. OK, that's kind of a good reason to build a quantum computer. Although some would argue, maybe Giffre, that we can do so well with classical computers that who would care? But maybe we don't agree. OK, so something that really created a lot of interest in quantum computers was Shor's discovery that there are certain tasks that are very difficult or slow in a classical computer, and that somehow become easy if you have access to a quantum computer. OK, so of course, there was a lot of excitation around these ideas. But then with time, we have learned that there are not so many things, or at least we haven't found so many things that one can do faster with a quantum computer, so that's a bit of a not so happy thing. And maybe a third reason to build a quantum computer is, as Preskill argues, that, well, in physics, we have managed to get access to the very small and to the very large, but we don't have access to states that are highly entangled. OK, so this is the entanglement frontier, and this is another reason to build a quantum computer. So if you allow me, maybe I would add to these reasons that Mallory's famous quote, because it's there, I think that's kind of a good reason for a theoretical physicist to do something. OK. So the main difficulty, so right now we can control small quantum systems. We can make them interact at will and so on. But we still have a big problem before we can construct a quantum computer, which is that this our systems, the quantum system that we can use, they cohere because of interactions with the environment. And well, definitely, we cannot control them perfectly. So just imagine trying to implement some arbitrary unitary with perfect control. That's not possible. So we need some sort of control of, or like error correction, OK? And there are two main approaches to this. One is the active approach. So in the active approach, what we are, so this is called fault-tolerant quantum computation, and it's very generic. So it would apply to a large class of different quantum systems. So I will say more about this later. But for now, let me just say that in this approach, we actively monitor the system in order to somehow keep track of errors. So we do this by measuring the system. And in this way, we extract the entropy that the noise will introduce in the computer. So the nice thing about this approach is that we have some beautiful threshold theorems from the 90s that tell us that as long as our qubits have a noise level that is below some threshold, below some level, then we can conduct arbitrarily complex quantum computation, no matter how many qubits you need or how long the computation is, you will be able to do it without having to find a less noisy system. Okay, so you are just good with that noise level for any size of computation. Now, an alternative approach, which can be called passive, is to find some sort of self-correcting quantum system. So this would be either something that some phase that we find in nature that we engineer. So we have now some Hamiltonian system. And instead of having to actively monitor the system, it will be, so our system will be in contact with some thermal bath. And what will happen is that even though, you know, entropy will tend to grow, it will be compensated, like this kind of growth will be compensated by an increase in energy, so that when the energy, like when the temperature is below some critical value, you know, the free energy will tend to increase with these changes, so energy is more important. And what will happen at the end of the day is that in trying to minimize the free energy, the system will stay, or the logical, or sorry, the quantum information that we want to protect will stay safe. So we know that this is possible, but it's possible in for a high number of spatial dimensions. Okay, so for example, I had some results where in six dimensions we could implement the whole computation in this kind of self-correcting way. But what, you know, we would like something in three dimensions, and actually we don't know if such a thing exists. Okay, so this is a very important open problem. Now the curious thing is that either way that you go, topological methods seems to be very important. So definitely in the self-correcting case, and in the fault tolerant case, the topological approach is, you know, only one of many approaches. But as it turns out, as we get closer to build a quantum computer, topological techniques have become very prominent, and the main, basically, if you want to do a quantum computer with solid state qubits, then you are thinking of using topological methods nowadays. In fact, you know, in the future, maybe there is, as Persky has suggested, there is no clear distinction between the active and the passive approaches. It is more like a continuum where maybe you have some self-correcting, some degree of self-correction from the topological origin, and then on top of that, you build some fault tolerance setting. So with that, I finish with the motivation. Now, let me say something about topological codes, and in particular, why I like to work on them. So before I can do that, I need to explain a bit what error correction is, quantum error correction, or how it works. So there are two main pillars to it. On the one hand, there is redundancy. So we want to protect some quantum information. We call that logical information. For example, we could have a qubit, logical qubit. And we are going to encode this qubit into a much larger Hilbert space, okay, composed of many physical qubits. So the reason to want to have all these extra degrees of freedom is that with them, we can now define something called check operators. Okay, so this is a commuting set of observables that we can measure in order to obtain information about which errors are afflicting our system. Okay, so as I said before, we are going to use this information to extract the noise from the system. So the information that we get from these check operators is called the error syndrome, and we will appear later in the talk. So this is one thing, redundancy, that's basic, but redundancy by itself would not work if noise was completely lacking a structure, okay, if it was completely random. So in order to use this information, this error syndrome, it is important that some errors are more likely than others. Okay, so for example, the most typical situation is that noise is somehow local, so that there is a larger chance that a few qubits are affected by noise rather than a large number of qubits. Okay, and this will be natural in some settings, like if our qubits are interacting with the environment separately in a weak form and so on. So, you know, it's possible to justify with physical assumptions that noise will have such a nice structure, in particular a local structure. So what is special about topological codes within quantum error correction? Well, the topological codes were introduced by Kitaev, and they have three main characteristics. The first one is that our qubits are on some sort of physical lattice. It could be two-dimensional, as in this picture, or three-dimensional, or higher dimensional. For practical reasons, the best case is 2D. That's what the people in the labs can do. It would be desirable if they could reach also 3D, but it's not so easy. Now, the second thing is that check operators, the things that we need to measure to extract information about noise, these guys are going to be local. Okay, so they only involve a few qubits in some small neighborhood. Okay, for example, in this picture, I have these four qubits that compose a check operator. And finally, the third and very important property is that is this thing called local indistinguishability, where if I'm given access only to a set of qubits, some region of the system that is not large compared to the system, okay, so somehow it doesn't encompass the whole system in some way, So whenever I have access to such a region, I will not be able to learn anything about the logical information, about encoded information. Okay. So it should be clear from this definition that these codes are rather practical. First of all, because indeed in the lab, often we will, particularly in the case of solid state qubits, we are going to be faced with such a lattice of qubits. And moreover, the interactions between the qubits will not be arbitrary, but we will be limited probably to interactions between neighbors. And in the other case, it is advantageous that we only need to implement like these local measurements, because we can do that just by using these local interactions. So first reason to study topological codes is that they are practical. Now, regarding this local indistinguishability, for those of you that know topological ordering condensed matter, you will see the connection. So topological ordering condensed matter. So we have several ground states, and they look the same locally, but they have this indistinguishability property, right? So they look the same locally, but then globally they are not the same. So there is this strong connection between topological codes and topological order. Okay, so this is one of the connections between, more generally, these topological codes and other areas of physics. Okay, so somehow it is because of this locality of the codes that they have a kind of physical flavor that allows to think of them in this kind of physical way. So for example, in the condensed matter side, so we have that the bulk of the code is described as some topological order, and then we can describe boundaries as condensates, and we can introduce other kind of defects by using the symmetry of the excitations on these topologically ordered systems, and so on. So basically the idea is that we can think physically about something that in principle is just a code. So for a much, if we were in a larger class of codes, we wouldn't be able to do that generically. So it's kind of an advantage. Also a limitation, but also an advantage. A different kind of connection exists with, say, the realm of statistical physics. And this comes when you think about error correction. So in topological codes, as in any other code, like there will be two regimes. One where, if you don't have too many errors, you are going, as you increase the system size, you are going to be able to protect your information perfectly with probability almost one. And as you know, as your noise level gets over a certain threshold, if you have too many errors, now, as you increase the system size, you only make things worse. Okay, so you will basically, with probability one, you will get just noise, logical noise. So this kind of distinction between these two phases turns out to map under, for some codes and so on, to phase transitions in certain classical statistical models. So in the simplest cases, it will correspond to, for example, some sort of ISIM model. Okay. So it's very useful to have this kind of picture of, for example, we can borrow results from statistical physics and so on. And there could be other kind of connections with other physical systems, and I will discuss some later. Okay, so second reason to study topological codes is that they are just interesting because of this physical side to them. Now, why are they called topological codes? So actually in this talk, there will be not much topology, only in this slide, and it's only as an illustration. So first of all, not all codes are really topological in this sense, but many of the so-called topological codes are topological in this way. So for example, the number of logical qubits will depend on general features of the geometry of the code. So for example, we could have some code here with some boundaries colored in two different ways. And what matters is the number of boundaries of each color, nothing else. So I can deform the whole thing, and I will still have the same number of encoded qubits, the same amount, the same kind of protective information. Similarly, we can think of operations where we deform these codes over time. Okay. So this here, it corresponds to actually, so it might look a bit awkward. So here we have two different codes. Okay, then as they evolve over time, they merge in some way, and then they separate again. And this whole thing is supposed to implement a certain unitary gate on the qubits that are encoded by these guys. Okay, so actually, this awkward-looking thing is part of the main current direction to build a quantum computer with solid-state qubits. Yes, I mentioned it in passing. And the idea is that even if I deform the shape of this thing, it will still implement the same. Okay, so what matters is the general shape, and in that sense, it is topological, just because there is an underlying TQFT. Okay, so with that, I finish. Oh, I should say that, yes, third reason to work with topological codes is that they are fun, okay? Just because of this topological side, and also, why not, because of the connection with other physical systems. All right. So now, I would like to draw a line, between some of my works in this field, in particular works that are related to the locality of operations and that have to do with color codes. Okay, so let me start discussing more in a bit more detail what fault tolerance is or how we do fault tolerant quantum computation. So our first thing is that information will be always encoded. Okay. So this means that, so before, okay, we had, so here on the left side, I have some components of a circuit, a general quantum computing circuit. So it will be, we have gates, we have initialization, and we have measurements. Those elements will make up a circuit, and I'm going to substitute them by gadgets. So the idea is that now that each physical qubit line is substituted by a thick line representing a logical qubit, okay, so its logical qubit is composed of many physical qubits, and its components, so the gates and initialization and so on, each of these guys is substituted by some quantum circuit, okay, that takes care of implementing the corresponding logical gate or logical initialization and so on. Now, on top of this, because noise will accumulate during the computation, we need some sort of error correction procedure. Okay, so that will prevent noise from accumulating. And for this to work, it is very important that our operations, in particular our encoded gates, our gadgets to implement these logical gates, preserve the structure of noise. So if noise is local, we would like it to preserve these locality properties. So the simplest way to do this, to have this kind of fault tolerant gates, is to consider transversal gates. So in a transversal gate, so now consider, think of just one encoded logical qubit. Okay, so it will be composed by several physical qubits. Here I'm depicting four. Of course, there will be many more. And the idea is that in order to implement some sort of quantum gate on the logical information, I'm going to just apply a unitary to each of the physical qubits. Okay. So of course, that this is possible, I mean, it's not trivial that such a thing is possible. It will depend on like the structure of my code and so on. And in fact, it so turns out that irrespective of which code you choose, you will never find a universal set of transversal gates. A universal set means that we can implement any desired quantum unitary by using this set of gates. So there is this caveat. We will never have universality just by using transversal gates. Now, the nice thing about transversal gates is that, as I'm depicting here, if I have an error that is localized just on a single qubit, after I apply the gates, because if they operate perfectly, the end result will be that the only qubit that is noisy is exactly the same one that was before. Okay, so the other qubits have not been affected by noise, and in that sense, noise doesn't spread. So that's in that particular sense, transversal gates are optimal because noise doesn't spread at all. Okay, and since we are focused on the locality of noise, that's very good. Now, a natural question is, can we put together this idea of transversal gates and topological codes? The answer is yes. Okay, there is a class of codes called color codes. And the main feature of these guys is that, well, first of all, you can define them for any number of dimensions, starting with two dimensions. And as you increase the dimensionality of the system, you get more and more powerful sets of transversal gates. So in particular, in two dimensions, well, remember that we can never get universality. So what matters is how limited we are. So in two dimensions, in order to recover universality, we need to do something called distillation. Okay, so this is something that consumes many noisy computational resources to produce just like a few less noisy computational resources. So somehow it's a very wasteful way of doing computation, but it works. Okay. Now, if you go to three dimensions, your gates have become a bit stronger, and now you don't need to do distillation. Instead, you can get to universality just by adding basically error correction. So in order to implement arbitrary gates, we need to do some initialization and measurements, but basically the main extra ingredient that is that we introduce an error correction. Also, in order to get the gates to be local in a space, we need four spatial dimensions. Okay, I want to emphasize that this is just for the original color codes. Later I will discuss like more recent developments. And then as you increase the dimensions, you get like stronger sets of gates, but basically you cannot go out of this problem of that you cannot get universality. And this is a generic problem for arbitrary codes assignments. So this motivates considering larger sets of gates or like of approaches. And this leads to the idea of using local gates. Okay, so this just means that we are going to use a finite depth quantum circuit. So for example, here I'm depicting a circuit with two layers, okay? So we have a first layer of gates and then one layer where there is one gate. And as before, because there is a finite number of layers, errors, well, before errors didn't spread at all, now they will spread, but they will spread only a bit, okay? So maybe we have like here an error on a single qubit will map to an error on say three qubits or any number of qubits. Moreover, if we are in some sort of qubit lattice and our gates are geometrically local, what we will see as here in the lower part of the picture is that if we have, say, a qubit that suffered from some error, after we apply the gates, this error will only spread to some region around this qubit. Okay. So in that sense, these kind of local gates preserve the locality of noise and they are good for topological codes. Now, it is unclear whether, to the best of my knowledge, it is unclear whether it is possible to get a universal set of gates out of such things, but we have several negative results in different kind of scenarios. And an interesting thing that comes out of these negative results, or no good results, is that actually you cannot do any better than you can do with color codes within the class of codes. So color codes belong to a class of codes known as topological stabilizer codes. That is, you know, very important class because we understand it well. And the thing is that even if you know, in color codes you are only using transversal gates, even if you allow for local gates, you cannot do any better. So in that sense, it's kind of disappointing. So we need something else. And in order to introduce a new element, what I propose is that we introduce, so we keep the locality of quantum operations, but we introduce global classical computation. We are going to assume that this classical computation is noiseless. So now again, I have several layers of like a finite depth quantum circuit, but you know, my quantum operations will have classical outputs and inputs, and these classical outputs will be classically processed, not locally, but globally. And then the result of these computations will be used as the input of the next layer. Now, a problem with this kind of approach is that now it is not automatic that errors will not spread. Okay, so on the quantum side, it is still true that, you know, my circuit is finite depth, so errors in principle will only spread like some finite number of qubits. But if, you know, if I have the noise itself will go into the, so if I have some noisy, output, some classical input for my classical computation, then, you know, because my classical computation, the corresponding input will affect the whole system, or the output of this computation will become the input of gates that belong to the whole system. So in principle, you know, yeah, a very small error could spread into something very large. So we need to be very careful, because now it is not automatic that noise will not spread. That's the difficulty of using this approach. But the nice thing is that actually there are no limitations within this approach. Okay, so at least for three spatial dimensions, we have some generalization of color codes, which are called gauge color codes. And so for these guys, we can implement all the gadgets. So be it like the gadgets for gates, for measurements, for initialization, all these guys can be implemented in this kind of with this kind of quantum local setting. And moreover, the error correction itself, maybe most surprisingly, can also be made quantum local. Okay, so there are no limitations at all if one considers this kind of gates. Now, somehow the most surprising part, at least for me, is that error correction itself can mean in a quantum local way, so I want to discuss this next in a bit more of detail. So this is a kind of recent result. And I want to discuss it because it shows, you know, a nice connection with physics, in particular with gauge fields. So because of this, I will go into a certain level of detail. Okay, so first of all, what is so special about single shot error correction? So in topological error correction, or in any kind of quantum error correction, we can distinguish between an ideal case and a noisy case. So in the ideal case, we just have some encoded information that, you know, suffer from some noise, but now we are going to be able to process this with a perfect quantum computer, one which has absolutely no noise. So then what we would do is we just measure the error syndrome, okay? We do that perfectly. We then take that information, the error syndrome, and process it classically to produce some result that tells us which is the operator that we need to apply to correct. So in the case of topological codes, the syndrome extraction only involves these check operators that are local. Therefore, this is a local operation. Then the decoding is purely classical, and the correction stage is again local because the operator that I need to apply is just a tensor product in the kind of codes that I'm interested. So this topological stabilizer codes, basically. So the whole thing is a quantum local operation. Okay, when I'm in the ideal case. Now, when I consider the noisy case, there is a problem. So now, when I extract the syndrome, you know, I will not get the right syndrome, but I will get some noisy form of it. And this is problematic because actually error correction is very sensitive to errors in the syndrome. So if I, you know, like a small error in the syndrome can give rise to a large error in the correction states. So because of this, I need to do something about this. So the obvious solution is to repeat these measurements that give me the syndrome, so I repeat them a number of times. The more accuracy that I want, I will have to repeat a larger number of times, and because of this, my processor is no longer quantum local. Okay, so I cannot have a finite depth quantum circuit to do this. Now, it just so happens that sometimes, even when we are in a noisy case, so for some codes, we have this single shot property, just that because of the structure of error correction, even if the syndrome is noisy, this noise will not be dangerous. So, you know, local noise in the syndrome extraction somehow at the end of the day when we get to the correction states will only give rise to somewhat local noise. And this is what I'm calling single shot error correction. And it's indeed a quantum local operation because now there is only one layer of check operator measurements. Okay, so what is so difficult about doing single shot error correction? Let me illustrate it for the case of two or three dimensional topological codes. So in this kind of codes, errors can be visualized as strings, and the syndrome that I get, so if, you know, after an error happens in the form of a string, the syndrome that I get will correspond to the endpoints of this string. So here on the left hand, I have a picture where I have a set of like part of the lattice, and the qubits marked in red suffer from some error. Then when I go to measure the syndrome, if I get the syndrome without any errors, if I get the right syndrome, I will see some endpoints. Okay, so there are some check operators there that now give me an eigenvalue that signals that there was a string that had those endpoints. So this is one scenario. Now, another scenario is that there were no errors at all. So on the right-hand side, there were no errors at all in the system, but the syndrome measurements had some errors, so I actually see two endpoints, okay, but there is no string at all. So what I see in both cases is the same. I just see the two endpoints, and then, you know, I cannot distinguish these two cases, and the problem is that the case on the right becomes, as the strings becomes longer, the case on the right becomes much more likely, and therefore I can, you know, when the strings get to a certain size, I can no longer correct them because typically what I'm getting is just like some fake syndromes. Okay. So this is a problem. Of course, this arises because I'm doing just one set of measurements, right? If I was to repeat it, I would solve this problem, but I want to solve the problem in a different way. And for that, I need to talk about subsystem codes because these gauge color codes that I'm talking about are a case of subsystem codes. So before I say that, in error correction, we are using this extra degrees of freedom to define check operators. But actually, we don't need to use all our degrees of freedom in that way. Okay? So instead, we could reserve a number, maybe a large number of degrees of freedom, as Gates degrees of freedom. So if we were just doing noiseless error correction, these Gates degrees of freedom are just useless. They are completely inoperant in any way. However, when we have noisy error correction, they can become useful in different ways. So for example, to recall that from the check operators, we are going to get the error syndrome. Now, instead of measuring directly these check operators, we could measure some sort of Gates operators, and from them obtain a Gates syndrome. Okay? So from this Gates syndrome, then indirectly, we could get the error syndrome. This is something one can do. And how does it come useful? Well, we'll see that in the case of Gates color codes. So recall that we had that errors take the form of strings and they syndrome correspond to endpoints. Now, moreover, in these codes, it is possible to attach a charge to the syndromes. Okay, so now you can really think of them as some sort of particles with a charge. And then I'm going to measure some sort of Gates syndrome, and it will correspond to the field for this charge. So what I mean is that there is some sort of Gauss law. Okay, so remember the Gauss law tells us that there is a connection between the amount of charge in a region and the flux of the field going across the boundary of this region. So here I am allowed to talk about charge and field because I have this kind of connection. And now I can imagine two kind of scenarios. Okay, so if I, on the left-hand side, I'm measuring directly the error syndrome, and I have this scenario that I discussed a lot before where, you know, I could get this kind of fake endpoints. So there is no error at all, but I get these fake endpoints because there were like these two measurements that were wrong. Okay. Now, suppose to the contrary that, as in the right-hand side, I'm not measuring directly this error syndrome, but rather I'm measuring some sort of Gates syndrome that in some way, so the Gates syndromes here, I'm representing them by these like two-qubit measurements. In reality, I mean, of course, the system is not two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional, so there will be more qubits and so on, but just a picture. So the idea is that in order to get, as before, like these fake endpoints, now I will need to have a much larger set of wrong measurements, because what the wrong measurements give me is a wrong flux or a wrong field, okay? And this field has to connect these two distant charges, and therefore I need a number of wrong measurements that grows linearly with the distance between these two endpoints. Okay, so this is the thing. Now, if you imagine, for example, that errors can happen at measurements with some like independent constant probability, then as the distance between these two charges becomes larger, the probability for such a thing for such a set of measurements to occur will be exponentially small. Okay, so in this sense, we have a form of confinement. Okay. So this is the physical mechanism that makes it possible to have single sort of error correction in these 3D Gates color codes. And now you can wonder, okay, is this just like some fancy language that you are using from QCD or whatever to disguise what is basically just some error correction, or there is something else here? So there is something else. And to talk about that, let me say something about the structure of the Hilbert space of these subsystem codes. So in any code, we will have, so because we have these check operators that are this committed set of observables, our Hilbert space will be divided into, will be a sum of subspaces, each of them corresponding to a given syndrome. Okay. So in a conventional code, all I will find, you know, this the size of this Hilbert space will be just the one that corresponds to the logical qubits. But when I have a subsystem code, I find that each of these subspaces, these syndrome subspaces, is divided into subsystems. One is the logical subsystem, and the other one is the Gates subsystem. Okay. And in particular, the logical degrees of freedom might be very few, but the Gates degrees of freedom might be very large. So most of this space is actually the Gates subsystem. Now I can imagine writing down some Hamiltonian, okay, some combination of Gates operators. And what will this look like in this decomposition will be, so we have this sum over syndrome. And then because the Hamiltonian is made of Gates operators, it will act trivially on the logical subsystem, but it will have some non-trivial action on the gate subsystem. And this action will depend on the particular sector that we are in, but the particular syndrome. So this is kind of the general picture. And then in the case of gates color codes, what we have is that in the bulk of the system, at least, this gates subsystem looks like six copies of a C2 that is gauge theory. Okay, so now remember that the error syndrome is somehow labeling this, or like labeling this Hamiltonian. And in particular, in the case of the lattice gauge theory, the syndrome is giving us the source configuration for the lattice gauge theory. So it tells us where the charges are placed. And the gauge degrees of freedom simply correspond to the gauge speed. So this is kind of the physical picture that emerges. And then we can, you know, ask questions, because this is just kind of work in progress or work for the future. So our first thing is that, because in these codes, the boundary conditions are very tricky, so it's not clear what will be the interplay between these boundary conditions and the lattice gauge theory phases. Okay, so the different phases that we can find in this GT. But, you know, maybe we can find interesting things. For example, maybe we could have a gapless topological order. We could do this maybe by considering, instead of C2, Cn, where when n is sufficiently large, we will find, in the case of lattice gauge theory, there exists some gapless phases. So it will come down to whether that survives with the boundaries, or in an interesting way, given the boundary conditions. And then the main question out of all of this is, okay, can we find some sort of self-correction? Okay, some sort of self-correcting phase within this scenario, or maybe some sort of generalized scenario. Or can we learn something about why self-correction is too difficult or impossible? Something related to this. Okay, so since I have time, I will discuss it. So it turns out that, so somehow gauge codes, gauge color codes, can be used as a bridge between different kind of conventional non-subsystem color codes. Okay, so it turns out that, so before we just had like two-dimensional codes, three-dimensional codes, four-dimensional codes, and so on, and they live in like in their separate worlds. But turns out that by using gauge codes, you can move fault-tolerantly between these different codes by preserving logical information. Okay, so I can start with the 3D gauge color code, and I can make it into a two-dimensional code, or I can make it into a conventional kind of three-dimensional color code, and so on. And the technique to do this is called gauge fixing. It basically amounts to take some of these gauge degrees of freedom and fix them to some value to make them into check operators. Now, the interesting thing is that with this LGT picture, one can give a physical meaning to this. So basically, different phases of the lattice gauge theory will correspond to different gauge fixes. Okay, so in some phase, the bulk will become trivial, and I will end up with just having the boundary, and that will be the two-dimensional case, and so on. So this is kind of an interesting possibility to have this kind of picture. And just to finish, so beyond these more physical directions, so, and actually the kind of work that I have been doing lately and I intend to do in the near future, is to, well, first of all, go beyond the conventional fault tolerance. So for example, recently I was working on the case of time-correlated noise. So normally in fault tolerance, we consider noise that is weakly correlated in time, but one can have physical systems where time correlation is important. So then I wanted to see what happens in that case, particularly for topological codes. Another direction similarly in this kind of vein is that of considering permanent faults. So now my device, you know, I fabricated my device, but some parts of the device will be permanently faulty. And, you know, can I say something interesting about that? And actually, I can, and again, by using some nice physical pictures. So this is some work that is coming soon. So this is kind of going beyond the standard fault tolerance in a negative way, right? So finding new difficulties that one can face. But another direction is that, okay, some of these physical systems that we use to try to implement a quantum computer will have some nice features that go beyond what we usually assume in fault tolerance. So then it's nice to consider, okay, what can we do with those features? Yeah. So that's something that I also have in mind. And more generically, so now the kind of whole topological field is going beyond topological, in the sense that given or leaving aside these geometrical constraints. So now my qubits are not in a lattice, but I still keep this idea of local check operators. And, you know, in this scenario, it can be much more efficient. And well, there are many things that we still need to find out in this kind of codes. And then maybe just to mention that maybe you're surprised that I don't say anything about, say, holographic codes and this connection, this recent connections between ADS-CFT and error correction, particularly given that here I am with Rashi Takayanagi. And yeah, maybe there will be some work in the future about that, but for the moment, it's not a direction I'm working in. So with that, I will finish. Thank you. Okay, I hear you.
So I have a question about single shot error correction, really general question. So what is the significance of single shot error correction when it comes to like fault tolerance? So especially, I think you can reduce the overhead a little bit, but are there any other merits of using single shot error correction?
So, okay. I find it mostly maybe conceptually interesting, and I think it will open some new avenues. Like it allows you to think in different ways, and I have some ideas in that regard, but nothing I would like to discuss now. But yeah, I guess for me the most appealing is kind of the fundamental aspect of it, right? Like, because, you know, there are other ways in which we could do similar things. I mean, not exactly the same, but similar things. Mm-hmm. I can hear you guys.
Yeah. So, Hector, yes. Question about the local plus global classical.
Yes.
So, I guess, you said you could do universal, but doesn't that also let you do stuff like magic state distillation and pretty much everything?
Mm-hmm. What is your question?
Well, that's the question. Am I understanding correctly what you're including in that? I mean, what's excluded,
well,
basically?
I have to say that I'm only hearing half of the questions that you are. So now I've missed.
So the local gates.
Okay. Press four.
I'm really not hearing.
Sorry, we keep getting muted and then unmuted. So the local gates plus classical global operations.
Yes.
What's being excluded there compared to kind of more conventional fault tolerance scenarios?
What is being excluded? I'm not sure what you mean. Can you?
Well, you can do transversal gates there. Obviously, you can do magic state
mm-hmm.
distillation. Is there some way that?
Oh, well, okay. You're saying like how I'm limited in power, right?
Sorry, say again?
Yes, you're saying how I'm limited in power.
Yeah.
So, yes. So, no, you couldn't do distillation in the sense that if I'm asking that you are able to implement, you know, every operation with a finite depth quantum circuit, so.
But you can do stuff that's based on the classical information, right? And that doesn't have to have finite depth.
Exactly.
But you can only do one round of the quantum stuff, or you can do multiple rounds?
Well, a finite number, right?
You find
so that's the limitation.
Can you say that again?
Yes, so the limitation is that you only have a finite number of rounds.
Only a finite number of rounds.
Yes.
But okay. But surely in that case, you don't know how to do universal quantum computation. I mean, because, you know, we don't know, you know, if universal quantum computation can be done in finite quantum depth at all.
Okay, but here we are. I must say that I'm not hearing all the elements that you are saying at all, so that can be a problem in the communication. But yeah, so this is about individual gates, right? Not the
right
computation as a whole.
Okay, okay. So there's only finite number of rounds per
operation.
I see. So the distillation, you normally would have a log number of rounds, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I see.
And as we have discussed sometimes, Daniel, it is true, right, that you can use, you know, if you just wanted to get like some, you know, if you just, the English is not coming to me, sorry. But if you know, if you want your computation to be only like a constant times longer than the original non-fault-tolerant one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can, in this way, you can do it very straightforwardly, but there are other ways that almost achieve the same, right? But they are just completely different. And I think conceptually it's very interesting.
Okay.
Hector, I wanted to ask you,
yes.
I missed the physics picture in the connection. You mentioned gauge color code, and there was some gauge Hilbert space. But is there a connection with, so what, when you call it gauge, is it directly connected to lattice gauge theory?
Yeah, so I'm just saying that you have exactly the same degrees of freedom. So as you know, the Hilbert space in the lattice theory is a bit tricky, right? It's not really local. And you get the same kind of structure.
So let me ask you a very simple question. So if you
mm-hmm.
want to run, if you want to work with such codes, would you use the same degrees of freedom that you would, for instance, if in some call atom experiment, they can run some lattice gauge theory nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to run your code there? You know, is that just some?
I cannot answer that
analogy?
Yet. I don't think so because so. I mean, the whole thing is in the boundary conditions, so that's highly non-trivial.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Hector.
All right.